Good morning, everybody. A couple weeks ago, we started class by talking about how the U.S. is a country of immigrants and how everyone, except for African-Americans and Native Americans, at one point, go back in their family history, they immigrated to the U.S. The other thing that we talked about was this idea of, like, the black Greek system versus the white Greek system. We talk about things like the ways in which someone raised a question in their memos of, like, well, why do we have Black History Month but not a White History Month? And a lot of it, if you think about it, and this was reflected in your memos, was that predominantly in high school growing up, when you learn about American history, you learn about white American history. And so the idea of inserting a month or dedicating a month to learning more about African American history or other cultures is more of a statement that every other month is American history is taught, but not just American history, but white American history is taught. And so by having, like, African American History Month or other focus times, it's sort of a recognition that the predominant message that we get is the white version. Or a lot of you, even not even really aware of this, in your memos, you'll say, well, I just see myself as being American. And I pause when I read that, because what that's saying is to be American is to be white. There's just this implicit association in our minds. And it's not necessarily good or bad, it's just sort of, that's a good self-check of what your definition of being American is, and what being non-American or what a person of color, what are they? Non-American or part American? So a lot of this particular chapter, when it focuses on white people, it's kind of, I got mixed reactions from y'all. Some of you were like, well, this was just very weird. I'm not used to this, or this is stuff I've already known, so it's nothing special. Or to even see that, wow, there's even discrimination within the European American population. And I think part of the thing that really stood out to me was the fluidity of whiteness. Because right now, and even in what it says in the text, like post-1940, there's only one category for white person on the census. But prior to that, there were multiple categories for white people. And that's changed over time, and who fits into that category changes as well. And so on one level, there's hope that, you know, there's some people like the Irish Americans, the Irish immigrants who came into the U.S., and they were treated as second-class citizens or even third-class citizens. But then over time, their status shifted to being white. And so the question would be, is this a possibility for other immigrants or other people of other ethnicities and races? Can their status change such that they become white? So part of that is understanding the history of these groups, and in particular the white immigrants. And I'm going to show a video that sort of gives a very fast history of white immigrants to the U.S. and also the discrimination that they experience. And what this video doesn't cover by intention is the Native Americans, African Americans, and also the Asian Americans and their immigrant experience. So this video is just focused purely on white European immigrants.
Immigration. It's been the defining characteristic of America since before our country even began. So it's important to remind ourselves of our rich history, of where we all came from to create this one-of-a-kind melting pot of people that is the United States in the 21st century. Once word of the discovery of the New World spread throughout the Old World, the kingdoms and empires of Europe, many people began to plan journeys of their own across the Atlantic Ocean. Starting around 1620, tens of thousands of British, German, and Dutch, but mostly British Puritans, came to North America to escape religious persecution, or to search for better opportunity, or simply for an adventure. The Puritans spread throughout New England in the Northeast. The Dutch settled along the Hudson River in New York and established rich, successful trading posts in cities like New Amsterdam, which we now call New York City. English Quakers established the Pennsylvania colony and its commercial center, Philadelphia. More than 90% of these early colonists became farmers. And because they were living in small, widespread villages, disease didn't spread as easily as it could back in Europe, which kept the death rate among settlers in America low. All these farmers needed large families to help them farm, which caused the population to boom, especially in the New England colonies. As land became harder to come by along the coasts, The roughly 350,000 Scottish and Northern Irish who arrived throughout the 1700s settled inland in western Pennsylvania and along the Appalachians, deep into the south. The British sent 60,000 prisoners across the ocean to Georgia, although the only thing many of these men were guilty of was being poor and out of work. This is the population breakdown of the country around 1790, shortly after the colony's hard-won war of independence with the British and the adoption of the American Constitution, which officially created the United States. The Native American population was so decimated by disease, war, and migration to the West that only about 100,000 were left inside the territorial United States. After more than four decades of relatively little immigration into America after its founding, in the 1830s, tens of thousands of immigrants began arriving on her eastern shores, again, mainly from Britain, Ireland, and Germany. Some were attracted to the cheap farmland that was made available by westward expansion, while others took advantage of the manufacturing boom in the cities sparked by the Industrial Revolution. The Irish were mainly unskilled laborers who built most of the railroads and canals, took jobs in the emerging textile mill towns in the Northeast, or worked in the ports. About half of the Germans became farmers, mainly in the Midwest, and the other half became craftsmen in urban areas. After tripling from the decade before, in just two more decades, from the 1830s to the 1850s, the amount of immigrants arriving in the United States each year tripled again to about 170,000. By the 1850s, when the total population of the country passed 20 million and things began to get a bit crowded, America's first measurable anti-immigrant feelings began to take root, mainly targeting Irish Catholic immigrants who were arriving in large numbers to escape the poverty and death of the potato famine that was hitting them hard at home. But with a huge boom on the horizon, this early xenophobia was nothing compared to what would come later. Large steam-powered ships took to the seas after 1880, replacing the older, slower sailing ships, which meant it was suddenly much faster and cheaper to cross the ocean, making the dream of a journey to America more accessible to many around the world.
Processed and ticketed, they waited for their ship. They boarded in many parts of Europe and in many kinds of vessels, most to New York and some to other ports. But they had one thing in common. They were traveling steerage, and the steamship companies understood the profit in numbers.
Before long, millions of immigrants were arriving on America's shores. They passed through immigration processing stations like Ellis Island in New York and Angel Island in San Francisco Bay. This wave was much more diverse than before. Coming mainly from Southern Europe, it was led by Italians, Poles, Greeks, Swedes, Norwegians, Hungarians, Jews, Lebanese, and Syrians. This group was young. Most were under 30 years old. Mainly because an entire generation of the children of farmers and factory workers in Europe and the Russian Empire couldn't find work because the owners of the farms and factories preferred to have an efficient machine that they didn't have to pay do the work instead of a human being. Well, this was fine by America, whose steel, coal, automobile, textile, and garment production industries were booming. It happily took in this pool of eager, hard workers and put them to work in its growing industrial cities. It was during this 50-year immigration wave, from about 1870 to 1920, when many well-off, white, native-born Americans began to consider mass immigration a danger to the health and security of the country. They started actively organizing to exert political power to slow it down. In 1921, Congress pushed through a law that marked a turning point in American immigration policy, a law that passed the Senate 78-1. The Emergency Quota Act set strict limits on the amount of immigrants who would be allowed into the country each year. It was very effective. The number of new immigrants let in fell from over 800,000 in 1920 to just over 300,000 admitted in 1921. If the pace of immigration had been like a raging river, this law acted like a dam. But that drop-off in the flow of persons into America still didn't satisfy the anti-immigration crowd, who, just 3 years later in 1924, forced Congress to tighten the quota even more, established the Border Patrol, and stated that any undocumented immigrants who entered the country were subject to deportation. It's during this time that the definition of illegal alien was born.
Ah, the U.S. of A. A country made up of immigrants that can never seem to get over its fear of immigrants. While the attitude now might seem particularly cold, the U.S. is no rookie when it comes to treating immigrants with hostility. In fact, it's got quite a long track record of doing just that. Here's a sampling of the most anti-immigrant moments in U.S. history. Unlike now, when the frenzy is about keeping out the brown folk, back in the day, say the 1800s, Germans and Irish immigrants were also the targets. Arriving in droves, they sought a better life and fled political and religious persecution. In 1845 alone, 500,000 Irish crossed the Atlantic due to the Great Potato Famine. All these immigrants freaked out the quote-unquote natives. No, not those guys. These guys. Who even started a political party called the Native American Party, or the Know-Nothings because of their initial secrecy. They feared the influence of Catholics and lobbied for stricter immigration policy. At the turn of the century, the anti-immigration fervor turned to Italians when millions came to the U.S. for better wages. They worked some of the toughest jobs in mining, manufacturing, and construction. But they were resented as being so-called scabs, hired by employers when workers went on strike. In 1891, when a group of Italian immigrants was tried and acquitted for the murder of a New Orleans police chief, a mob stormed the jail where they were being held, dragged them out, and lynched them. One of the leaders of the mob, who went on to be governor of Louisiana, said that Italians were, quote, just a little worse than the Negro, being, if anything, filthier in their habits, lawless and treacherous.
So that provides an expansive amount of time, but what strikes me is that for most of you in this room, someone in your family had the experience of coming to the U.S., that they were immigrants, and whether it be on a ship that took almost a month to get here, or on a ship that took just a few days to get here, each of you, if you go back into your family's history, for most of you, they came over as immigrants. And so thinking about then also how the immigrants were treated, what strikes me is, especially even amongst the European immigrants, there's a hierarchy, that there is sort of a status, and the English were at the top, but then you have the Germans and the Irish and the Italians and the Polish and the Hungarians and the Syrians, and it sort of it trickles down, and there was discrimination that occurred within white Americans. And the unique thing about white Americans, European Americans, is that today there's very little differentiation made between what country of origin you're from, if you're white. And the question is, how did that shift occur? And part of it occurred through just intermarriage. In the U.S., for most of its history, you could marry, a white person could marry any other white person. Now, it used to be, if you were white, you couldn't marry a black person, or a black person couldn't marry a white person. It was actually illegal to do that. But within the white population, intermarriage could occur, and so then you have sort of a dissolving of the differences. But also, a Irish American could pass as an English American much more easily than, say, an Asian American could, or a Latino American. So there was passing that occurred. And I would argue that another reason why this shift occurred to where whiteness is sort of universally accepted is that it was done at the expense of people of greater color. So at the greater expense of black people and Latino people and Asian Americans to some extent, is that sort of what the Irish did, they organized in opposition to the black population and sort of said, well, we're more white than we are black through our behavior, through our language, through our characteristics. And so the way it was done by pointing out a group that was inferior to them. Now, this also actually occurs within the black population. There's double discrimination within the black population. If you have someone who, say, is black and homosexual, people within the black community will discriminate against someone who is homosexual, or there'll be some sort of double marginalization or double discrimination. So it isn't like the black community is immune to this practice, or within the Asian American community, they're immune to this practice. But, you know, if there is a hierarchy, the lower you go down the social hierarchy, the fewer people you have to discriminate against to push yourself up higher. My question is, and it was a lot of questions that you all asked in your memos, is at what point will we truly be sort of a colorblind society where the color of your skin will no longer matter, similar to how your European country of origin no longer matters. I mean, for all practical purposes, it doesn't matter whether you're German, Italian, or Irish, or English, or Scottish. I mean, people just, you know in your everyday experience, you're just not, that's not a category that you work through. And so the question is, could it be that at one point, race and ethnicity will sort of become a non-issue? We're going to do an exercise where you get up, we're going to do the sort of stretching across the room. If you think, in a sense, that we're already there, that race is more or less a non-issue, go down to that end of the room, and if you think it's going to take, like, one generation sort of put yourself in the middle, or two generations put yourself here, if you think, if you're more of the pessimist and you think we're never going to get to that place, then put yourself way in this corner. Okay, and we'll stretch out a little bit so you guys aren't too crowded. So the people down on this end, sort of state where you think we are in the process and how much more time it's going to take to get to a place where we're more or less a colorblind society. What about people on this end who think, you know, we've actually come a long way and we're almost there?
I think we're getting closer, I'd say. I think the fact that we're so, everyone's so accessible with, like, social media and the internet and things, and people can see your opinions, things like that, it becomes harder to be a minority opinion, which I think the minority is being racist these days. So I think that it's going in the right direction, but I still think we have a long way to go before it's completely.
And you say it's harder being a minority, or what was it that you said?
It's just harder to have, like, strong opinions like that that are go against the majority.
I see.
So I think it just gradually shifts towards non-racism, discrimination.
Mm-hmm.
But I still think we have a bit to go.
Yeah. Well, and one of the questions is, you know, one of the strategies is to assimilate. And so if you adopt the majority culture's culture, then you can sort of accelerate your social advantage. But then you do that at the cost of abandoning your own traditions, your own culture, your own religion, your own language, your own family traditions. So that's one strategy, a personal strategy for accelerating that process. What about people in the middle? How many years or how many generations do you put it taking us to reach a colorblind society?
I don't think you can really put a time frame on it. I think it's never going to be universal one way or another.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, like he said, we're getting closer. But I don't just see it going away ever.
Mm-hmm.
There's always going to be one side and one side.
So there'll always be some level of discrimination. It might not even be by
it's
skin color.
It's probably just going to be done in different ways, like it has been, how we've talked about in this class. Just,
mm-hmm.
You know, direct versus kind of indirect.
Yeah, I mean, even if we get to a place where we're colorblind, one of the social theories is that we're still going to find some dimension along which to discriminate people. You know, and so to whether it's then gender or other social differences. What about on this end, the people who are either pessimist or realist, however you want to put it?
I don't think it's going away, honestly, and not kind of what somebody over there was saying. I think a lot of the racism and discrimination is not done intentionally now, but I think that it's more of a mindset. So a lot of times when we discriminate or have these racial feelings towards people, it's not because, oh, I hate white people or black people or Asian people. It's because that's what my mind has been, you know, trained to feel. And so, like, for example, like if I walk into a classroom or a group setting and I'm going to meet new people, there's something in me that's sometimes going to draw towards other African-American people because that might be where my comfort level is.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess some people could say that's discrimination because I'm not giving the white people or the Asian students a fair chance.
Sure.
But it's not intentional. And so, yes, I think we've made progress. I don't think that these generations of practices and mindsets and traditions are just going to ever go away because there are things that have been passed down, and then in addition to that, it's your personal experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think in certain places in the United States, it's a lot worse than in Indiana, and in Indiana it's really bad sometimes, but I just don't think that it's ever going to get to the point where you just don't see it anymore. Like, it might be where we don't see lynchings and things like that, and but I think there's still going to be that that internalized racism,
mm-hmm.
And like I said, sometimes unintentionally, so.
Sure.
Well, we can go back to our seats. One thing that does stand out is a lot of times when they talk about Irish, how the Irish became white or how Italians became white, it's a generational story. You have the first generation, the generation that immigrated to the U.S., and then their children got an education and sort of did a little bit better, and then the next generation did a little bit better, and to the point where their social status was equivalent to other white European immigrants. If you look at the African-American population, they haven't followed that trajectory. So it isn't like, oh, well, just, you know, in one generation or two generations or at least three generations, it'll begin to equal out. Well, it's been over six generations since the abolition of slavery, and still the disparities exist. And so the trajectory or the narrative is not the same. And it's not because of inherent differences between the biological composition of African Americans compared to Italian Americans. There isn't anything particularly unique in that regard, but it's, I would argue, that part of the social structure adversely and uniquely inhibits, in particular, the African American population. But this is also true with Latino Americans. Originally, Latino Americans were characterized as white. A lot of them have a lot of Spanish roots, and their skin color is such that they're white. But then it switched to where they were non-white, to their people of color. And then over time, again, it switched back to where you have Hispanic white population. And so there is this sense of fluidity, but a lot of it is sort of, it's the people who set the rules. It's the people who write the history books, predominantly the white Americans, that sort of set up the system. Now, I don't know how it works. You know, people would say, well, why don't we just stop it? Well, it's one of these structural things that, as Mercedes says, is just sort of built into the system, and it's how the world works, or it's just normal. It's this idea of implicit bias or unconscious racism that just sort of persists in the system. And a lot of you said, well, actually, I think we're getting there. It's a fairly colorblind society. But if you just look at the statistics of the income disparities, there is really no, if we were truly in a colorblind society and people's income levels were equally distributed based on merit, it should show up that there's statistically no difference between the income of a white person versus a Latino person or a black person. It should all be a wash. If people are people and an income is distributed based on accomplishment and achievement, then there really should be no difference. It's just like if I looked at it, if I took everyone's blood type and I said, okay, let's see what the differences are in income based on blood type, we would find no statistically significant difference in income levels based on blood type, because blood type doesn't matter. Olivia.
I kind of feel like it's hard though for that to happen. Like, I don't know if it will eventually happen where there's no income disparity, but I feel like because of the way African Americans and Mexican Americans were treated initially in this country, they were set back. So we kind of, like as white people, had a step up and like a kind of like a false start,
mm-hmm,
compared,
mm-hmm,
to them. So they're still working up where we already had years and years of getting there.
Yeah. Yeah. So they're at a starting point disadvantage.
Yeah.
Yes.
I'm kind of building up on that. I think that if we can bring everybody up to the same level as far as like educational opportunities and like opportunities to better themselves, and then we will see that pay gap close. But I think that's because like educational opportunities and like opportunities to better yourself, like it's not equal across everyone, and when we make it equal for everyone, then like the pay difference will close itself.
Mm-hmm. But women are, with higher levels of education, are paid less than men who have equal or less than education levels, or even these statistics, are people with equal education levels. These are people at the same position in an organization, so same education level, same work experience, same everything, and the only difference is more or less their race. So I agree with you, on average, the reason why on average Latino Americans might make less than Caucasian Americans, it could be because of educational disparities. But then even when you control for education, you pick two people who have the same education level, there's still that difference. And that's where I think it's, to put it in perspective of something like blood type, which we know is completely random and has no association with job performance, we wouldn't expect to find any income difference. You know, you just, it would say, well, here's what the average income is of this whole population, and then if you break it up by blood type, the average by blood type is equivalent to the average in the population. Like, there's just no difference. But for whatever reason, or actually for structural reasons, I would argue that this internal sense of racism or discrimination creates these wage differences. And I don't know exactly how to change it. It's not even like the people who are setting the salary wages are intentionally saying, oh, you're a Latino, so I always take off 10% of what Latinos, their wages are, or what their salary is. I do know that there are some sociological and psychological aspects to negotiating wages in a position of negotiating what your salary would be. I don't know if any of you have been in that position. White males have a greater level of intrinsic confidence of negotiating, of saying, you know, sort of asserting what their value is, whereas oftentimes women or people, minorities, will be more hesitant, or also, like, particular, a woman won't want to come across as being aggressive or bossy, and so psychologically they hedge on negotiating their salary. And if your wages multiply over time, if you start off at a lower salary and everyone gets a certain percent increase over time, the gap will grow for women who didn't negotiate a higher salary. But it's not to say that women are weaker, but they're doing this strategically. They don't want to come in and be perceived as being bossy or overbearing. And so when you're negotiating your salary, that's a touchy topic to kind of say, hey, I want more. White males don't necessarily have that psychological barrier. If they exude confidence and assertiveness, that's seen as a positive quality. Whereas maybe a woman in the same situation giving the same storyline will be perceived differently, and that would actually get them starting off in the organization on the wrong foot. And so they're doing it strategically, but then it has consequences on income. So it isn't like, you know, you get a job, or hopefully you should realize this, it isn't you get a job and they say, here's your salary. Everything's negotiated. When you get your first job out of college and they say, well, here's what your starting pay is, you have a right to sort of say, actually, I think I'm worth more. And the only way you can really find that out is if you have two offers and you see someone else. I mean, because what are the chances you go and interview with two different organizations? There isn't a standard pay of what you're going to get paid. So one organization is going to offer you X amount and another organization is going to offer you Y. They're going to be different, most likely, unless you're getting paid the minimum wage. But even that, there's variation. And so you have an opportunity to negotiate what you think you're worth. And so that's where a lot of the income disparity comes. It's not necessarily the employer discriminating on the front end saying, well, if you're of this race or of this gender, here's what your pay is. I mean, that just isn't the case. But there are back and forth narratives that take place. I'm going to give each of you an opportunity to earn 100 extra credit points. So this is a one-time deal. Take one piece of paper, pass it back, roll up the paper into a ball, make it a good tight ball. The tighter you make it, the better, probably. Okay, so you will get 100 extra credit points if you can take the piece of paper. You have to stay in your seats, take the piece of paper that's in your hand, and make the basket. So you'll get 100 points. I'll write down so that we can remember who gets the 100 points. And what do you say? So we'll just start. We'll go down like this. And if you make it, you get 100 points.
Oh,
bank shot. Nice, Corey.
Oh,
David does not get it. Okay, let's start with Jeff. Oh, so close. Oh!
That's what I would have done.
Oh, came up short. Oh!
I'm trying to duck down.
Okay, we'll start with, where's Luke? Oh, so close. Oh, rim shot. Oh. Oh, very close. Now you have to keep your seat where it is.
You said you can.
Back at behind where it is. Good try.
I thought it was a
trick. Good try. Okay, so. Good try. So Charlie, Cole, Corey, and James. Goodness, this is almost as many points as the first exam. I'll write down that you guys get 100 points. What?
What's the catch?
There's no catch.
Oh, okay.
It's just that.
We got like 20 points for being further back.
For what?
For sitting further back and tempting.
Oh, well, that was just... I randomly assigned you to where your seat was so that it wouldn't be biased to, like, if people come in early or if things like that.
No,
just
not being biased.
Oh.
Closer opportunities.
What? Oh, they had an easier chance?
Yeah, I think so.
What do you guys think?
Yeah.
But I did this. I did it intentionally. I put all the names just randomly distributed into the classroom.
No, I know, but they're closer to them.
Sure. Mercedes?
This is, like, so off topic, but, like, all the black people are in the back, so I'm like, one right here.
Interesting. You know, you'll have to talk to your parents about that.
Yeah.
Because, and when I did that, I did first names, because I thought, well, maybe there's some... skewedness of last names and what letter it begins with, but this was just purely your first name. So, so what were you saying, Justin? I missed your request.
We should get like maybe 20% of the points that they got for sitting back here and attempting the shot.
Yeah. Okay. And so should David get points though?
No.
he's weak sauce, so. I don't know, what do you guys think?
I mean, you did it all random at the beginning, so I think it's fine.
How do we know it was random? Oh, because it's alphabetical.
Can we do a quick vote?
It's not random. Well, it's random in the sense that there is no logic to bias one group over another group. So that was the thing. I didn't want to say, well, okay, the people who came early who picked their seats sort of had an advantage. It's just purely a random assortment. You know, I could have attached a number to every one of your names and then just numbered it off. That would have been a similar random assortment. There'd still be people in the front, and there'd still be people in the back. I mean, there's always going to be some people who are in a better position than others.
So can we do a vote?
Olivia? what did you want to say, Olivia?
I don't think our athletic ability should affect our grade in this class.
Oh, I know, it won't. This is purely extra credit. So it does not affect your grade whatsoever. This is extra points. What?
They're like guaranteed an A now, unless they like seriously mess up. They'd have to like really mess up.
Well. Yeah, but it's not going to hurt you. Your grade and your performance, your grade based on your performance will still be the same. Yes.
Well, I'm competing against them up there too, so.
What if you cut the grade?
No, because this will be just added on top after everything's been decided.
So can we get 20 points?
What? Can you get 20 points?
It's just the fifth of what they got. Can we vote on it?
You want to vote on it? So what are you asking that we vote on?
A vote that we should.
If the people that didn't hit the shot got 3 points in comparison to 100.
Okay.
Give him a double or no, or we just...
The further back you are, the more percentage of points you get.
The further back you are, the more percentage of points? So,
yeah.
Okay. What? I'll be open to you guys putting out proposals. So what is the proposal?
Give him a double or nothing.
Give him another chance.
Double
or nothing, dude. It'd actually be double or negative 100, right?
No, they'd say it's zero if they didn't make it.
Give them a second chance.
Yeah.
Okay, what do you say, Jeff?
Should we just like divide like 400 between everyone?
Yeah.
That's a possibility.
Hell no.
What other options?
There's like getting a free throw line, and that's where we actually go.
Oh, create like one standard line where everyone throws from? Do you guys hear that?
Well, that's not fair, so no.
What?
Well, that's not fair.
Okay. Okay, so I'll entertain different options. So one is to have a free throw line. And the other one was 20 points to everyone who didn't.
Or we could do it like the closer you are, the less, like... So since there's 100 points in 5 rows, you could do 100 points. Well, they all have 100, basically, so in the front, then you could do 20, 40, 60, and 80, but I would say just do, like, 20.
So they would get 80 points in the back?
No, I think we should just do 20 to 40 points for everyone that missed it.
So, 20 to... Depending on, how I feel.
Yeah.
Okay, so you're giving me a range of...
I just think it's a great day, you should get 40 points.
Yeah, and you were saying, what was your proposal? 50. And then, Jeff, what was your proposal?
Divide 400 everyone.
400 divided by... How many are in here? Too bad for the people who didn't show up. Or wait, should we worry about the people who didn't show up?
No, those should have been here. Okay.
Okay, so they're automatically out of the race. Any other proposed options?
Oh, you can just keep the 100.
Just keep it as is. Yeah. I mean, and that's what it will be. Unless you guys can come up with another alternative. So, I'll let you... I like the idea of voting. You basically, as a class, have 400 points to work with. And you can decide how you want them distributed. If there's no action, it'll just be what that is, and we'll just move forward.
Yeah.
Do we split up between the people that didn't make it only?
No. No, it's the whole class.
So guys.
Yeah. No, so it's 400 total points, and you guys can decide how you want to distribute them.
The people who did make it have to think about if they were in the back and had less of an opportunity, that they would want it to be split up.
Let's put them in the back and see if they can still make it.
Just give them a double or nothing.
Or we could all just vote like we originally wanted.
Do what?
A
class vote? Of what? And what's the vote on?
I don't think we should be limited to only 400 points.
Boy, it's completely up to you. If you guys, right now, these four people are going to get 100 points each. If you have the option to change that, to sort of discuss and sort of propose something, hear some good proposals. If you can come up with a system for redistributing the 400, I'm very open to that. You have to be, in order to change what this is, there has to be consensus, though. So you need to lobby.
So basically they're our board.
What?
Essentially they're acting as board members. If they want to give up
20. Oh, sure, yeah.
I don't think they should have a vote. It has to be consensus. Everybody has to agree, then obviously they're not going to take any.
Can you say something?
Charlie wants 100 points. Mercedes.
I think what we need to keep in mind is, realistically, somebody who has a privilege is not necessarily just going to give it up to help other people out. And so I think that I get what they're saying, because if I have 100, I just be like, well, you guys won't get anything. But on the other side, it's like, hey, but that's not fair to us, and so we have to keep in mind both sides of this activity.
Sure, yeah. And they worked hard to get this. I mean, they did. They deserved it.
Not as hard as us.
Wait, they didn't? Who said they didn't? That they didn't? What do you mean, Doctor?
They didn't work any harder than we did to be up there, and they just got lucky.
Oh, they got lucky.
Well, they have first names that start before mine.
Okay. Yeah, but David starts with a D, and
it's my off day. I don't know.
It's his off day, I guess.
I motion to vote that we split up the point to you.
I second.
I'm for.
What? For us to get points, I'm going to vote for them, obviously. I'll take it as a point.
Well, but you also have to recognize, I mean, we can do the vote now, but you also have to recognize you need consensus in the room, so it might be beneficial to have dialogue.
Everyone has to agree on it?
Can we just
get one more round?
What?
Two more people just
happen
to
hit it, then we can disperse those points evenly and everyone can get more points.
Well, but you guys didn't. You had the chance. I mean, I thought I would be working with like 1,000 points, but we're working 400, which is still good. I mean, that's basically, that's two assignments that you can bail on. So do you want to do a vote? Are you guys ready to vote?
Yeah.
And so it's dividing them up evenly. And so basically, you're saying the people who weren't here don't get any points?
No.
Does anyone feel like the people who weren't here should get some points?
No.
Okay, are you ready to vote?
Yeah.
Okay, all those in favor of dividing it up evenly amongst everyone that's present in the classroom, raise your hand.
Come on, guys.
Come on.
And you're not either?
Oh, wait. Oh, you made it. That's right.
Okay, so we don't have... Now, so you have an opportunity to persuade these three guys.
Cash offers them.
Yep. Are you guys open to being persuaded, or should they not waste their breath?
I'd listen, but... I don't know what we would do.
Yeah.
I'd give you my points. I don't have any.
We give them like more though.
Nah.
I mean, like they can get like 25, but we can get like 15 or maybe something like that. We can get maybe 10-ish or something.
Mercedes?
Okay, this is a stretch. But if we have 400, so there's coming four people with, or three people.
Four people
with 400. And there's three black people. So if you share with the black people, it's not 18 students, so you guys still get a lot. And then we get some too. Sorry, everybody else, but gotta look out for my people.
Okay, the voting's going to close in 1 minute. So, and if you can't come to consensus, then it'll be as is. It'll be they get the 400.
And you got to look at them, not us.
It's not, I mean, I'm neutral in this.
I think you guys have to think about how rough the group projects are going to be throughout the semester, and it's going to be pretty upset with you.
Yeah.
How much is the peer review worth?
Oh, yeah. What? Okay, voting has closed. So you guys, I assume you want to take your 400?
Yeah.
Okay, and Cole, do you want to take your 400 points?
Yes.
Do you want to take your 400?
I voted to split it up.
Okay, but so in it's right now, you basically get your 100. Do you want your 400?
I can just split it up with everybody else. I'm not taking 100 points.
Okay.
Woo!
What?
Split it.
You're going to split it amongst
you.
Woo! So I will tally those up. This is reality. And the tensions that you feel are just real. I mean, I don't blame you guys.
They would have done the same thing if they're in my spot, so I'm not
sure.
I'm sorry.
If you guys didn't do what you did.
Yeah. So listen, I guarantee you, it plays out this way every time. The people in the farthest back are the loudest and in most opposition. This is not fair. Surprisingly, the people in the front, especially the ones who made it, don't really say much. They're just quiet. They're fine. They're sitting pretty good. people like David, who didn't make it, are kind of like, I screwed up. I had the easiest chance to make it, and I just blew it. I choked. Yeah. And they're just kind of feeling internally like, what was I doing? So when we talk about privilege, privilege is something that was just sort of, it just randomly was brought to you. Yes, there is generation that builds up over it, but you in and of yourself didn't do anything special to earn it or deserve it. It's just an advantage that you have. And it's actually an advantage that you have that sort of, because there's people who are at a higher disadvantage than you. So like your ability to make it was because you were sitting here in front and there was no one else in front of you. Mm-hmm. And the people who were in the back were at an even greater disadvantage because they had a lot of like crowd to sort of throw it through. So in a sense, at the start of this exercise, you guys had a much higher likelihood of success. Your chances of succeeding, your chance, was super high. Like you had, let's say, a 90% chance of succeeding. 9 out of 10 times you would make that basket. Back there, I don't even know if you can make it 1 out of 10. Like almost, you didn't even have a chance. From the very beginning, you didn't have a chance. It still takes effort. David had a high percent chance of succeeding, but it takes effort. Yeah, so privilege doesn't guarantee success. It just makes the chance of success a lot higher. So there's still effort. It's not saying it was just sort of preordained that you would get those extra 100 points. So then, that's how society works, is some people start off with a higher advantage than others. That's just the reality. That's a social reality. And a lot of you say, well, how do we change that? How do we fix that? Or why can't we just sort of give everyone sort of equal? Why don't we just do the free throw line? Put everyone at the free throw line and just make it even and equal. Well, society is already in motion, so you can't stop the game. You can't just sort of hit the reset button. What it takes is, predominantly, these four people. You know, when we talk about the Occupy movement and the 1%, these guys are the 1% in this scenario. And the 1%, we don't really hear them talk. And they don't want to give up their hard-earned money. And in a sense, these guys are saying, hey, I got my 100 points. This is going to help me. This is actually going to help me in this class. And why would I put myself at a disadvantage for other people? So, in a sense, what's your confidence that this system is going to change? Just even based on what did you observe in this exercise that either gives you hope or gives you pessimism with regard to social inequality actually changing?
I had an ambition or like thought of staying in my seat and kind of like doing the best that I could with my, like, what was given to me. And even then, I was, like, shot back. So, like, that's really pessimistic in my opinion.
When I said you couldn't, correct. When you were being innovative and saying, I'm going to sort of
stay
cheat.
Not really cheat, but just, like, use what I was given. Just, like, stay in
sure.
the seat and make the best.
Yeah, so play by the rules. But
I
yeah.
got shot.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's a good. So that was, that was a shot of pessimism. Of like, goodness, I can't even try and, I recognize my very disadvantaged situation, so I'm going to try and make the best of it or try and work the system. And even that, I was like, well, no, that's your position. You got to start from there. What other things did, you know, just observations. And again, I don't mean to sort of single out the four, but you have choices too. And it's fine. It's not good or bad. It's actually what you did is what society does. So it's in fact, some people would say, gosh, why would you give up your points? You had 100 points? Why'd you give them up? Like, that's not smart. That's not strategic. That's not wise. Olivia.
I just think it's interesting how we've talked about how white males are the superior and dominant race, and the four that ended up 1A are all white males. And obviously their parents, when they named them, didn't know that this game would happen. We're trying to put them at an advantage, but it's still interesting that they're the ones who came out.
You know what's interesting, though, when I've done this exercise before? You're right, this time it has been white males. It doesn't matter who's in the front. Women, students of color. There's always some, and it's not based on gender or race. There's some that feel a sense of, well, maybe, do you guys want to share what your logic is of keeping the points?
I didn't get enough sleep last night, so I was mad, and I want my points.
Okay. There's part of their biography. Do you have, I made that up. What?
I made that
okay.
up.
No, but, I mean, would you be willing to share just sort of your thought process?
I thought 100 was more than 18.
And it's sort of self-interest, self-protection?
I wouldn't blame anybody else for keeping their 100 points here. I mean, I was at an advantage, so.
Yeah. James?
I just thought it was interesting, like, if you would have given me $100, I wouldn't have given it up, but I feel like it's extra credit, and you should plan on not even needing the extra credit in this class, and how it seemed like it was, like, a competition, like, well, they're getting the points, why don't we get the points? And kind of just, like, just because you don't have the opportunity as others doesn't mean you're, like, entitled to help from them. You are more, like, privileged, I guess.
Because if you're saying if you didn't get the points...
Like, just because we got put closer up doesn't mean that, like, we didn't choose to go here. We just were here.
Sure, yeah.
I don't think other people should be entitled to our luck.
Yes. But you... So you didn't choose your place in the classroom, but you did have choice in how the points should be distributed. Right? I mean, because 19 people wanted to distribute them evenly, but there was 3 people who stopped that from happening. And it happened to be, not by coincidence, 3 people that had 100 points. There was no, you know, so it's the people who have the points sort of have the power. And sort of what they decide dictates the outcomes for the rest of society.
Yeah. Are you doing 400 divided by 22 for everybody else then?
No.
What are you doing for them?
I'm going to take James and Corey's and divide them up to the whole group. You guys get 100 each.
So they'll get 200 divided by 22?
Yeah. Or not by 22. You guys get your 100. Any other observations that just sort of dynamics that you see? And even like being honest with yourself, if you're in their shoes, would you have given up 100 points? I would put money on the fact that at least half of you wouldn't. And I just know that because I've done this before.
Give you a chance.
What? Give you a chance. So it's a very complicated social dynamic, this idea of privilege. I think it's important to recognize that some of the advantages that we have set us up either to have a higher likelihood of success, doesn't guarantee success, but it gives us a much higher probability of succeeding. And if we're starting at a point of high disadvantage, it doesn't guarantee that you're going to fail, but it makes it a lot harder. And so everyone right now is at IU, but how you got here and what you overcame to get here and the statistics of the likelihood of actually getting into IU, for some of you, you are a shoo-in. The day you were born, we could have put $1,000 on the fact that you're going to get into IU. It was so statistically probable that you would get in that we would bet tons of money on it. For others of you, it's like, I don't know. It really depends because their starting point is a lot different. So when we talk about this idea of privilege and sort of what it seeps into is this idea of, well, then if we redistribute the points or the money, or the power, then it means that it's going to be taking away money from people that have the power, that have the assets, that have the resources. And so the narrative that plays out is this idea of reverse discrimination. And that doesn't sit well with people. What I'm curious to know is, your experience of reverse discrimination. If you feel like, to some extent, you've been adversely affected because of affirmative action policies or sort of systems to sort of advantage more disadvantaged groups or historically disadvantaged groups, if you think reverse discrimination, if you've experienced it and you think it happens, I want you to come up to this end of the room. And if you're more of a person where you're like, yeah, I hear the term reverse discrimination, but when I read about it in the book and when I thought about it just in my everyday experience, it's actually more of a myth. It's not taking a spot that I deserved and giving it to someone else, but it's a different type of system that actually doesn't adversely affect me. It just helps those who are historically disadvantaged. So stand up, come to the front of the room. Or if you think reverse discrimination is sort of active and alive and you've experienced it, sway towards this end of the room. If you don't really think reverse discrimination has an impact, go towards the back of the room. Okay, so the people who think that reverse discrimination is active and alive and you experience it, share.
Well, just from my perspective, I think so based on scholarships. I do not come from money at all. Like, I worked really hard throughout high school. I was really active, and I had a lot of challenges thrown my way, and I still didn't receive any scholarships. Mm-hmm. So just on that end,
so, yeah. So college scholarships would be one situation where you experience reverse discrimination. You know, all of these statistics I find very fascinating. I apply for grants and research funding or jobs, and a lot of times it says we give preference to historically disadvantaged applicants, so people of color or other social minorities. And whenever I read that, I'm like, I just got sort of eliminated. What I don't realize, and this is statistically shown, especially with scholarships, there are thousands and thousands and thousands of scholarships out there. There are some, like you said, that are specifically targeted for certain populations. The vast majority don't have any specification like that. And surprisingly, the vast majority of scholarships of those kind go to European Americans, white people. Part of it is the advantage of sort of knowing how to apply for a scholarship, having a good social network to write that letter of recommendation when the CEO of the company writes the letter of recommendation, or when you have a friend of a friend who's on the board of that scholarship committee, you get it. So I have the same perspective as you, because I experience it, where I'm going to apply for a grant, and it says we give preference, you know, this particular organization gives preference to people of color or minorities, and I had this reaction. But if I look at the flip side, again, it's sort of like, why do we have Black History Month? Well, it's because the other 11 months are White History Month. But we don't think of it through that lens. So I see what you're saying, but there, and it's valid, but there's a larger story that just we don't hear about, if that makes sense. What other people who experience reverse discrimination, can you give an example or just see where you say where you see it playing out?
I was trying to think of an example. I can't really. I just feel like I see it. Well, I can't really. I don't have an example, a specific example.
Mm-hmm. But your visceral experience is such that, yeah, it happens.
Yeah.
It seems like there's a lot when it comes to like Black social groups. I think that's where I've seen it the most. Like, especially in Black fraternities and sororities, like, because they're historically African American, you don't see a lot of Caucasians and Asians and Hispanics. There are some places, some schools where there's a lot of white people in mm-hmm. their chapters, but I know here, like being Greek and being Black at IU, it's like you don't see like white girls coming to join Zeta Phi Beta, and like if there is somebody, they don't feel comfortable approaching or coming to our rush, our informational, because like I don't belong there, and so then there are some people that feel like, well, I get that you're historically Black, but why is it fair that I can't join, which is not a thing? And so I think a lot of white people sometimes, they think because these are Black organizations you can't come and be a part of it, even though nobody's really told them.
Sure.
That.
Yeah. So it's more you see exclusion.
Yeah.
That. People who don't see reverse discrimination being played out much, what's sort of your narrative or sort of your experience of it?
I'm cognizant of it, just like you, like in the exact same situation where I see how it could be a thing, and I picture in my head, like, I say, there's no way that I am, like, adversely affected by this because I have so many opportunities around me
mm-hmm.
that extend beyond whatever circumstance I'm feeling reverse discrimination in. So, like, I do feel it, and I'm, like, I'm aware of it and think it's possible in my head, but I say, like, there's no way I'm adversely affected by this because there's so many other things to do.
Mm-hmm. And even if you are adversely affected by it, you're saying you're willing to take the hit if because
right.
probably another opportunity is going to pop up. Yes, Olivia.
I just feel like our society, like, it definitely goes on, it definitely happens, but it's not focused on. Like, in the media, it's always black people being discriminated against, and those are the stories you hear about.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, during for our reading last night, like, it was just rare for me to read about and hear about cases like that, because that's not very common in all of our my history classes growing up. That just wasn't discussed.
Sure.
So I think it definitely happens, but it's just not really discussed
mm-hmm.
or
mm-hmm.
heard about.
Yeah. Well, yeah. There's a Supreme Court case of it's in New Haven, Connecticut. The firefighters. It was a team of white firefighters and one Latino who were basically brought a case before the Supreme Court that they weren't getting promotions on schedule like they should have because of reverse discrimination, and the Supreme Court decided in their favor. So that, you know, and even the other cases in the book of where discrimination, either reverse discrimination or discrimination because of being white on some level, there are cases of it. You're right, it's not publicized, but I do think there is this sort of underlying narrative that a lot of people believe, and it's true. What's not true is the extent to which it happens, but this idea of reverse discrimination. Like, it does happen, but I think we inflate the extent to which it happens and the extent to which a person doesn't get into, you know, the joke was when a white person doesn't get into Harvard University, it's because they let a black person in their spot. When a black person doesn't get into Harvard University, it's like, you didn't get into Harvard. Why are those stories different? You know, why doesn't, for the white person, why isn't the narrative, I didn't get into Harvard? But it's like, well, I didn't get in because that person took my spot. It's just so we have this storyline that plays out, I would say reinforces some of this discrimination, unconscious bias, social inequality that sort of perpetuates in society. So we can go back to our seats. And part of what the book talked about in regards to reverse discrimination is that the main, especially within organizations, the main idea of these affirmative action policies and practices are granting equal access to the organization. So you think about, like, the high school that you went to, you probably had an IU representative come to your college during college day, where you sort of can go and see all the different colleges that you could possibly go to. What affirmative action would do is say, let's not just go to the same high schools that we've gone to all the time, but let's expand the high schools that we go to. And actually, let's make sure that we're not missing the schools that are higher proportions of people of color, because those tend to be higher proportions of lower income schools. The idea with affirmative action is do the same recruiting as broadly as you would to any other high school. And same with an organization. Don't overlook perhaps the historically black college on career day, but be intentional of providing equal access. And I think another thing that stands out, even with affirmative action and these perceived quotas, that there's study after study that shows that when people are hiring someone, they give preference, even if the people are the exact same qualification, preference is given to the white applicant. So built into the system is this implicit bias. So they did these audit studies where they send in applications, and the only difference was that they used a white-sounding name like Chad, and they use a black-sounding name. That's the only difference between the applications. And then they look who gets called back for an interview, and it's the person with the white-sounding name that gets called back. Again, it's just like blood type. It shouldn't have any bearing. You know, if you put blood type on the application and you try to see, well, who's more likely to get called back, you would see there'd be no variation. But when you sort of signal white versus black, there's just differences. And so even when we have these quota systems in place or these affirmative action policies, reverse discrimination isn't sort of swaying it such that there's this huge shift to now all the people of color are getting the interviews and getting the jobs and getting into college. The last thing I want to cover was in the book, I talked about developing a white racial consciousness, and I found this very interesting. And a lot of you asked about it, and what does it mean? And I would say, especially amongst the white people in this room, is being cognizant of your whiteness and what that means. Because we just don't simply, as a white person, I don't sit there and think about it. I don't dwell on it. Yet I guarantee you, people of color, when they're in a social setting and they think about, goodness, if I perform poorly on this exam or in this class, there's going to be an association like, oh, it's because of my color. And so then there's this added pressure of like, well, I want to represent the people of my community well. And if I do bad, it's going to reflect poorly on my people. Whereas in the white community, if you do bad, you do bad. Or like the story of Timothy McVeigh, who bombed the Oklahoma City Center. They didn't after that say, oh, all white people are terrorists. It was just like, oh yeah, there's one person who did extremist activity. But it doesn't get imputed upon the whole culture or community. But when you're a person of color, your activity sort of becomes demonstrative of the whole community. Part of this developing a white racial consciousness is sort of saying, okay, what does it mean to be white in a predominantly white society, in a society where white people have a lot of the power and a lot of the resources? What are the implications of that? What are the inherent advantages? And what is within my realm? Because at the end of the day, it's the white people, it's the people with the 400 points who ultimately have the power to make the change. So a lot of you have asked, well, how do we change this? How do we make it so that there's no longer income inequality? Or how do we make it so that there's no longer racial discrimination? It's the people with the 400 points. I mean, I think that exercise demonstrates it pretty clearly. Whatever they decide is sort of going to be what happens. And inertia is such that it's not going to change. It's just going to continue as is, unless the people with the 400 points decide, let's be creative about this. Let's think about possibilities. You have no obligation to. I mean, you just simply don't. There's no law or any type of obligation to do it, but you are the ones who have the power to do it. And I then would say more broadly, if you're in this classroom, if you're a student at IU, you are part of that powerful percent that actually has the capacity to make the change. So each of you who said, well, if I was in their shoes, I would have redistributed the 100 points. Well, you are in their shoes. By being an IU grad, you are that powerful percent that actually has the power to make choices. It'll come at a certain sacrifice to yourself. There's no question about that. But you do have the power. You are the ones who are in this front row and have the power to choose sort of how things are going to be moving forward. So in the memos, a lot of you guys asked, how do we change the dynamic that's in society of the privileged people having advantage and having access to resources, and how do you motivate them to redistribute those resources? And I don't have a straight answer. I don't have a good answer because, as the class exercise illustrated, there's just this inherent tendency to want to keep the advantage that you have. A lot of you asked about things like, well, just doesn't make sense for the people with all the resources to have to redistribute them to people who didn't necessarily earn them or deserve them. And I think for me, that makes sense as well. This idea of just a zero-sum game where it's like, okay, you have a pot of 400 points and how should we redistribute them? You know, you could think of it in the same way of money, you know, look at your bank account and let's just let everyone have an even amount in their bank account. That just doesn't make sense. And so for me, it's ideas of thinking creatively of how to remove barriers to access, how to create equal or equivalent opportunities for people such that it's not just a zero-sum game, and that if someone else is going to be moved up, then I have to move down. Like, I think about that with my kids in school. I have friends who do a lot of education reform stuff, and I said, my kid is in an elementary school that's ranked, I think it's, you know, there's a ranking of 1 to 10, and his school is a 10, and I would be hard-pressed to say, oh, okay, well, let's take this school that has a 2 in terms of resources and bump it up 2 notches, and then have my kid's school drop down 2 notches. Like, I mean, this is my kid's education. This is central, and there's no way that I'm going to compromise or sacrifice my kid's education just to bump up someone else. And so there's this challenge that how do you remedy this? And I don't have an easy solution, but I do know that the power to make the changes rests in those that have the privilege and those that have the resources. That's the only way it's going to happen. And someone asked, like, well, is there a time in history when this did happen? The best example that I came up with is in England in the 1800s. There was basically equivalent of a senator in the British Parliament, and his name was William Wilberforce. And basically, he was this very privileged, very powerful person with lots of resources, and he basically took on the establishment and said that the slave trade was just unethical and it needed to be banned, it needed to be stopped. And so it's equivalent to any major person in the Republican or Democratic Party going up against the establishment and saying, this needs to stop. But there might have been a lot of grassroots activity of people saying, you know, even slaves obviously saying this is unethical. They didn't have a strong enough power and voice to make the change, but it was someone who was in the establishment who had the power to do that. All right, we're all done.